Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Amit Patel. Amit is the Managing Director at Owl Ventures. Amit, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on today.
Excited to be here.
Fantastic. So, hey, let's start with Owl. What's the firm's investment thesis?
Yeah, happy to
share a little bit more about Owl and kind of what we focus on. So, Owl Ventures, we're focused exclusively on the education technology sector. So we're investing in early stage and growth stage companies in the education sector across the education spectrum. And so that's everything from early learning to K-12 to higher education to adult learning or corporate learning, kind of however you want to refer to that fourth category. We also invest in what we like to call the EdTech Plus category. So that's EdTech plus other major sectors like FinTech or health tech. So an example of that is we have a company like Hazel Health in our portfolio, which is bringing telemedicine services to the K-12 sector. Or we have companies like Leap, which is helping students as they're thinking about going to study abroad, access loans for school. And so kind of bringing together that EdTech plus FinTech type of, coordination. And so, as I mentioned, we're stage agnostic. We're investing here in the US and we're also investing globally. So we have companies in Latin America, Africa, Europe, as well as various parts of Asia. And, you know, I'd say succinctly put, we're basically focused on investing in the world's best education technology companies.
So I love the fact that you expanded the thesis to the full continuum, because I can imagine there's a whole host of intersecting opportunity, and not just in learning, but supporting education. It's great. So with that, you know, I know you know the question was coming: artificial intelligence disrupting everything.
Exactly.
You know, it seems like every other day I read an article talking about how AI is influencing learning. What's your perspective?
Yeah, I think
we are extremely excited about the potential that generative AI has on the education technology sector. And I'll actually back up by saying this intersection that between AI and education has existed for quite a bit of time. And Owl itself, we started the firm about 11 years ago. And actually, even in Fund One, we had companies that were leveraging things like machine learning and natural language processing, which are the building blocks of AI, and incorporating that into whatever they were building for the education sector. Now, it was much more on like kind of the back end, or like kind of not necessarily kind of interfacing with exactly the student, the learner, or the teacher, or the end consumer in the way that generative AI has been. But that intersection has existed kind of since the beginning when we started Owl. And so, you know, the fact that generative AI has now made kind of this technology intersect in a way that it is being leveraged by students and learners as well as educators makes it even more exciting. And I think there's a few what I would describe as ways we are seeing kind of this initial wave of generative AI start to impact education. And so I'll highlight a few of those. So the first is, when it comes to personalization, the potential that generative AI has to really tailor either content or curriculum or just your path, learning path, to actually be personalized to your interests, your proximal like zone of development, which is like where you actually want to keep learners, to keep them, you know, challenged but yet engaged and not frustrated, and the ability to create that almost in real time is finally here, right? Because if you think about like kind of what personalized learning used to be like before generative AI actually existed, what was it? It was somebody had to actually think about the journeys that kind of learners would go on. All of those had to be like kind of almost pre-programmed into whatever the application was. And if you were deviating from that, you were almost trying to be force-fit to kind of one of the existing paths, versus now, it's really generating that in real time, and you don't have to have all of those kind of paths predefined. So I'd say that's like bucket one, which we're starting to see is like really, really exciting. I think a second bucket that you're starting to see generative AI start to really play a significant role is when it comes to data analytics and starting to unearth insights that previously might have taken somebody a significant amount of time to actually start to realize. And so this, as you can imagine, like when you're talking about a classroom environment and you have a single teacher that's trying to understand what's happening with 30 different students, could take an extraordinary amount of time. And, you know, it requires that teacher to not only like start to do things in their planning periods, but on the, you know, weekends and on the evenings and things like that. And so the potential that generative AI has to say, hey, let me actually do all of that analysis, present the takeaways from you, and then you as the teacher can start to really focus on, okay, well, what does this mean I'm actually going to do with the student, and focus on that one-on-one interaction or that small group instruction, which again has been shown in academic research to really have a significant impact on student outcomes. Like that is pretty exciting, the fact that that generative AI can actually do that. And you know, I'd say the third piece that we see in terms of what generative AI can do is just in terms of creating like actual meaningful assessments, like in terms of, you know, not just like the regular multiple choice questions, but really getting into how do we assess whether this individual or this student has actually learned this concept? And so starting to interface in not just written formats, but actually in a conversational format, in a presentation format, maybe debating a topic or something like that. And so you're starting to have this multimodal interaction that can actually happen with content, so that you're really understanding, does this individual have a surface level understanding of this topic, or is it something that's a deep understanding of this topic? So that's just, you know, three that are off the top of my head, but I do think that the potential that AI has when it comes to the education technology sector is you know, immense, and we're really excited about that.
So it sounds like, if I can share back with what I heard, it's, you know, artificial intelligence is optimizing efficacy to the point where we're going to start personalizing learning at a per student or per learner basis.
Absolutely. I think spot on.
So I've got a ton more questions I want to ask you, but before we do, I always find it's kind of valuable if we take a step back briefly, and if you'd share with us your career progression and how it led to OWL. It'd be great to, you know, learn how that's formed your perspectives on ed tech today.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I've been with OWL since we were started. So like I said, we've the firm's been in existence since for about 11 years now. And my entire career and my entire journey has been in the education sector. And, you know, I'd say maybe just kind of starting at the very beginning, you know, my initial company was, I started while I was still an undergrad, was a tutoring company that kind of served students in the Houston, Dallas-Fort Worth and College Station areas. And the reason why I would say I got attracted to the education sector in the first place was actually has to do with my parents' journey. And so my parents immigrated to the US. They're of Indian origin, but my dad was born in India. My mom was born in Kenya. And, you know, when I had the chance to go and visit the village, for example, where my dad grew up, and see kind of the circumstances that he was in India, and then his ability to, you know, kind of move all the way to the other side of the world and, you know, get the education that he did, get the job that he did, and then ultimately set up the life that him and my mom did for my sister and me. It was absolutely inspiring. And, you know, I remember that I asked them, I was just like, you know, kind of, how did you do this? Or, you know, how did this actually happen? Because, you know, the elementary school that he went to was located in the village that he was in. And then the middle school that he went to was located in the next town over. And the high school that he was located in was, you know, kind of a few towns over. And, you know, so it was a real testament in terms of your commitment to education to actually kind of graduate from high school. And, you know, there's two things that he said when I asked them. I was like, how is this actually possible? That really stuck with me. And one was education. And then two, he said, was random acts of kindness, where people just went out of their way to be helpful to me in a way that, you know, I was obviously very thankful for, but they did not need to do. And seeing the impact that education had on his life, my mom's life, and then subsequently our lives, and now, like, you know, the next generation's life, you know, I said that, you know, the thing that I would like to do with my life is to make high quality education as accessible to as many learners as possible. And so that's what inspired that kind of initial tutoring company that I started while I was in college. And then that led me to Mathnasium, which is an after school math learning center, similar to Kumon and Sylvan, helped start their quality assurance program as well as their sales training program. I believe they might be up to like 1,000 locations now in the US and about 30 different countries. And then after that, I actually ended up going to Success Academies in New York, which is a charter school network in New York. Again, I believe they might be up to something like 40 schools or so now in New York, and eventually ended up becoming the head of technology for Success Academies. And so had the chance to buy, build, and deploy education technology solutions within the network itself, you know, including companies like Dreambox, which is a, you know, kind of personalized adaptive math learning platform for elementary school students that we eventually ended up actually investing in out of OWL as one of our fund one investments. And so really, I would say, got excited about the potential that education technology had to kind of make that learning as accessible for as many learners as possible. And so was really excited to be a part of this OWL journey so far for the first decade of the firm's history. And the other thing, I, you know, kind of did end up going to grad school to get my MBA and master's in education as well. And was pretty important to me to really study kind of the education field and understand kind of what had been tried before. Why did certain things work? Why didn't certain things work? And then also from a policy perspective, how has that impacted kind of education? And then also from a research perspective, right? Like, what are the actual, you know, circumstances that have been shown to achieve, you know, kind of really efficacious results versus what types of, you know, things might actually impact like student outcomes?
Well, so that's an incredible and inspiring story. You know, and as I listen to the journey that your dad had, you know, I immediately start thinking about opportunities to improve the process. You know, it's one thing, you know, you get handed off from teacher to teacher and who has to relearn your learning style each year, let alone going to a different school because of coming to the U.S. But I start just thinking about, you know, all these different opportunities to optimize, you know, the way, at least in the United States, how education plays out. And so, you know, let me just start big picture before we start asking you just about it, you know, how you look at conduct due diligence, the things that you're bullish on right now. I admit, I want to take advantage that you have an amazing perspective. So like in the US, a lot of people aren't aware that, you know, K through 12 are given the summers off because we used to be an agrarian society. And yeah. Families needed kids home to tend the fields. You know, fast forward today, industrial revolution, multiple industrial revolutions have taken place, and you can't help but wonder, is this the best, you know, is this the best approach? And so, you know, how do you think about that? You know, do you say, hey, I'm not going to go lobby my state educational system. I'm going to just look for solutions that can help bridge the gap so students, you know, continue to exercise the right muscles over the summer. You know, not lose anything in between grades.
Yeah, I think this is a very important point that you're kind of honing in on here. And what I would say is there has been kind of historically this almost like siloed version of how our education system worked, right? Like you had the K-12 system, and that was kind of the siloed system of the K-12. And again, when, you know, higher education was initially contemplated, a very small percentage of students from the K-12 system were actually going on to, you know, get higher education. And largely that in, you know, the history was reserved for, you know, folks coming from, you know, upper class or, you know, kind of backgrounds and things like that. And so I do think the world that we have moved to today is requiring kind of more of that continuum of learning to happen. And I would say where we are today, I fundamentally believe that this concept of, hey, you are going to be done with formal education at 18 or 22, maybe if you go to school, higher education, or let's say maybe sometime in your 30s or so, if you're going to grad school, depending on how long the program is, I think we have fundamentally moved away from that society, right? I think there's a few things that have led to that. One is, you know, we live in a global economy. We live second in a digital economy, and the pace of, I would say, competition as well as innovation that is happening is, you know, kind of getting faster and faster and more accelerated. And coming back to AI, like that has only kind of, you know, played into that acceleration, if you will. And so this idea of, hey, I'm going to graduate at 22 and then somehow be able to have like a successful career for the next, you know, call it 50 years or so, or 40 years, whatever amount of time you're thinking about working, without having to require some type of upskilling or reskilling or kind of lifelong learning to actually happen, I don't think that's a reality of where we live anymore, right? Sure. And so I think, you know, and you're starting to see institutions start to do this where, you know, some of the most innovative K-12 schools, the way that they're actually measuring success isn't just how many students are graduating high school with us. They're starting to say, well, what is the starting salary for students when they're actually entering the workforce? And then what do the lifetime earnings of our students look like as they are progressing in their career? And, you know, the partnership that's starting to occur between college institutions and employers to say, hey, how do we ensure that students are graduating from college with the right set of experience that allows them to be as attractive to employers in that global economy and as likely to contribute value as soon as they're hired? And so I do think there's really innovative, you know, kind of partnerships that are starting to happen to kind of break down these silos as I described. And the last point I'd make on this is, you know, the way that we're actually seeing this manifest in the US is, you know, today, the majority of higher education students in the US are non-traditional students, right? They're not your 18-year-old that just graduated from high school and is now going to college. They are, you know, somebody in their 30s or 40s. They might be married. They have kids. They might have a full-time job. They're thinking about switching careers. And so the way that we actually need to think about catering to these individuals and making education as accessible as possible is, hey, look, you can, you know, take the class on campus. You can kind of watch the lecture maybe at your own convenience. You can take the test from wherever you might want to, because guess what? You might be working during this time, or you might have a family obligation at this date and things like that. And so kind of starting to rethink how we can, you know, help these individuals through their lifelong education journey, I think is where we're seeing the education system start to shift.
Yeah. You know, it's, as I'm listening to you, I'm reminded of healthcare, where there's a really big emphasis on the continuity of care, because stakeholders know that outcomes are improved when, you know, in simplest terms, the left hand knows what the right hand's doing. And so, you know, hearing that there's a shift from institutions who recognize like, hey, this yardstick is long and doesn't have to stop once you get your high school diploma, you know, is really encouraging. Because you're right. I mean, you know, I often, you know, we talked about before the podcast, we both have kids, we love them, we want to see them succeed, and we know that the world is changing. And we know that the access to information is increasing. We know that, for better or for worse, AI is taking over certain jobs. And so we have a responsibility to ask as well, okay, well, what role do we play in this world? And I think you hit the nail on the head. We're going to be doing nonstop learning. Because if we stop, you know, you have to question, you know, do you become irrelevant? I hate to say it, but at least when I look at ChatGPT and the power that it's at my fingertips, I mean, it's material.
Yeah, I mean, think like
just to bring your, you know, give another example of that point that you're just making, it's like you talk to students that are graduating from the top computer science programs out there. And this is even before generative AI was kind of in the ethos.
About 5 years
after they graduated, like the most innovative technology companies were building with a completely different stack.
Yeah.
Right. And so that pace of innovation was already happening. Like I said, the innovation of generative AI has just kind of continued to accelerate that. And so to your point, I think in order to like kind of keep up with this pace of innovation, it's going to require that commitment to lifelong learning.
So I totally agree. And I've got one more structural question I'd love to get your perspective in, and maybe this dovetails into the, you know, how you guys look at making investments. So, you know, I did my undergrad. I ended up pursuing a professional designation within investment analysis, you know, and continue to read and study today. But it's evolved, and it's gone from what was essentially, I think, an experience similar to many students through undergrad, where it's rote memorization to pass an exam, versus, you know, so more theory than practical learning, which, you know, today I learn a lot faster because I'm doing, and I just find myself a more mature, and I'm in this position where I know that when I'm hands-on, I better understand the subject. How does Alan look at that? And how do you, you personally, how do you think about that and opportunities for improvement? And then like I said a moment ago, if you want to dovetail that into how you're starting to look at investment opportunities, it'd be great to start getting perspective with your VC hat on as well.
I think this, the point that you're making definitely resonates. And in the sense that this idea of learning, you know, kind of facts just for an assessment to prove that you learned that set of facts. First of all, there's a lot of questions that you have with that approach, right? And what I mean by that is, you know, the question is like, if you're not actually understanding why those facts are actually helpful, how are you going to use this knowledge? Most likely scenario is you're probably just committing that to like kind of some type of short-term memory, right? And so, again, coming back to the point that I was making earlier in our conversation, which is if you truly understand, okay, well, I am learning physics and, you know, let's say I am interested, for example, in sports and like can kind of start to understand like, okay, if I hit a ball or if I shoot a ball, like this is the arc of the ball and this is how the physics formula like kind of impacts that. If you can connect it to how you might apply it in the real world, you're much more likely to actually understand kind of it at a much deeper level. And ultimately, if we think about like kind of our ability as like a species to kind of continue to push the boundaries of our understanding of, you know, how our world works, how the universe works, like how technology works and so forth, the idea is to get to that deeper layer of understanding so that you can kind of keep pushing the frontier forward, right? And without that, it's difficult to like actually kind of end up pushing that frontier forward. And so I think, you know, one of the things that I've appreciated again with experience is, hey, listen, it's not just about being like a great test taker. Like that is one element of like the education process, but it's also about understanding like, how am I actually going to use this? And how can I start to, you know, challenge the assumptions that are actually being made within this, you know, argument that's being presented to me? And how can I start to look at it from a different perspective? How can I debate the pros and cons of this? And ultimately, like if I come back to like kind of the grad school experience that I had, like, you know, the most valuable part of that education wasn't just like memorizing a certain set of facts. It was like actually coming in and thinking about a case study or thinking about something that had been passed in the education world as policy and starting to say, well, what were the pros and cons of this? Like, and if you had been kind of considering these trade-offs, like, how would you have balanced that? Because that's not a question that you can answer with like 2 + 2 = 4. And that is the right answer, right? Like the world that we live in is much more complicated. And I think understanding how you are going to make decisions without having like 100% insight on actually like what the outcome could be, I think is, first of all, an extremely important skill for individuals to learn. And then B is going to be necessary as, again, you're required to do that in kind of a professional environment, which I think dovetails nicely into like, well, ultimately, what are we doing in venture, which is, you know, trying to make decisions on investments that we might or might not make with the amount of information that we do have based on kind of the company's history and trajectory to date. And so, you know, I'd say for us, when we think about companies that we're looking at, we ultimately think about three different categories that we try to look at a company and kind of make an analysis on. I'd say bucket number one is, you know, kind of what I would describe as business fundamentals of the business and or of the company. And what I mean by that is, listen, if you're a later stage company, what has like the historical performance of the business look like? How accurate have you been in like kind of projections versus reality? What do unit economics of that business look like? Obviously, if you're an early stage company or just starting out, maybe some of that information isn't there. Then what we're more interested in is like, well, what is the thesis around the competitive advantage that actually exists around this company, right? And if you're going to have either fast followers enter the market, or if you're going to have kind of some of the larger players start to, you know, have you on their radar and say, hey, we're going to start to offer potentially similar looking types of options, like what ultimately is going to allow this company to continue on the trajectory that it's on. And, you know, we start to look at kind of all of that data in what I would describe as like kind of bucket number one to assess the business fundamentals associated with that company. I think bucket number two that we look at is the founders of the business and, you know, to the extent that they do actually have an executive team, like the executive team of that business. And, you know, I think the reason why that is, you know, we're interested in, you know, not only the data associated with the company or the analytics and the financial performance of the company, we're actually interested in the humans associated with the company as well too. And, you know, especially if you're talking about investing in these companies at the early stage, you know, in many cases, you know, you're talking about 7, 10 plus years that you'll be partnering with these individuals and working alongside them. And so we want to make sure that we believe in not just the idea, but the individuals that are going to execute on that idea. And then vice versa, we want them to be excited to be working with us as well too. And so I would say bucket number two is kind of that the human element, if you will, or the team element that we're looking at. And then bucket number three, I would say, is more specific to education, which is like kind of the efficacy or outcomes associated with this actual company. And so we, you know, kind of, again, come back to what I was saying earlier is like try to take a look at research in terms of, okay, what has been shown to actually have an impact? How important is that to the company in terms of how they've incorporated that into product development or, you know, kind of RCTs or rapid cycle efficacy studies that they might have performed? And then ultimately, like, you know, how are they thinking about that, using that as a competitive differentiation in the long run? Because it's our belief that the companies that are going to be the largest, the most successful, and the longest lasting in the sector are the ones that are going to have the most efficacious solutions, because otherwise it's going to be very difficult to stand out from the competition.
I mean, the thesis makes good sense. And it's, you know, consistent with what I've heard with other successful investors in the space. And so let me ask, we're recording this late May 2025. What in particular are you currently bullish on in the ed tech space?
Yeah, I think there's a few different things that I would say we're pretty excited about. So first, I think is, you know, kind of coming back to some of the latest innovation that's been introduced through AI and other technologies is the ability to kind of leverage, whether it's AR and VR or AI in general, to actually help kind of upskill and reskill folks. And I think a lot of the technologies that we've seen historically has been really focused on, you know, kind of white collar jobs, but we're now starting to see that really focus across the kind of workforce and say, how can we help with blue collar jobs or gray collar jobs? And so we are starting to see kind of really interesting companies out there that are addressing kind of this upskilling and reskilling across that spectrum from blue collar to white collar. And so I'd say that's an area that we're pretty excited about, and we're starting to see real traction and real application with that, especially given, you know, I'd say if you were talking about, you know, call it 10 years ago, there was a lot of maybe excitement about AR and VR and the application of it, but like kind of the real world adoption was lagging versus now, like those two are really, I think, meeting the need and the price point and so forth of driving real value there. So that's bucket number one. I would say bucket number two of what we're pretty excited about right now is kind of just the global shift in like kind of demographics and needs that are happening on a global scale at the moment. And so I'll give a couple of examples just to like kind of make this like a real. So, you know, if you take a look at like where are the world's largest like student populations today, like the two countries where the world's largest student populations are in India and China. And then like you fast forward, like call it, you know, 20 years or 30 years, like where is the world's largest student population going to be? It's actually going to be on the continent of Africa, right? And so as you start to think about like where is innovative education going to be necessary, like on the continent of Africa, they don't actually have like the physical university infrastructure to serve the demand that is expected over the coming decades. And so what I would say is like the innovation that we're seeing happen there is almost, if I made the analogy to like the idea of like how cell phones like kind of leapfrog landlines in Africa, we're starting to see new ways of kind of starting to think about like higher education or lifelong learning in Africa happen in a way that, you know, other places in the world like maybe didn't get to immediately because they had the ability to like kind of talk about like physical university infrastructures and the more traditional ways of doing education. And so I think that just like kind of brings me to the point that, you know, the innovation that we are going to see in the sector is happening globally, right? Like this desire for high quality education, it's not limited to like one part of the world or, you know, a certain, you know, specific demographic within the human population or anything like that. And so we are seeing, you know, really interesting companies in Africa, in Southeast Asia, South Asia, the MENA region, Latin America. And so I do think that is something that I'm really excited about. And that brings me to my third point, which is, you know, the talent that we are seeing enter the education technology sector is absolutely amazing. And the people that are self-selecting into the education technology sector are, you know, some of the smartest technologists and educators in the world that are coming together and saying, hey, you know, the thing that I want to dedicate my life to is ensuring that we are, you know, providing that high quality education to the next generation and for future generations to come. And these are people that I would say like could have almost any job in the world that they want. And they are specifically saying, hey, I am very excited to take my talent, my time, and my life's work and dedicate it to this sector. And so that I would say is like the thing that, you know, really inspires me and really gets me out of bed and why I'm excited about, you know, not just this coming decade for Elle, but the coming decades for Elle.
Yeah, I mean, it's super encouraging. I have to admit, I need to get your take on Neuralink as well.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I think that is a technology that will, whenever it does kind of start to have more of a ubiquitous like kind of presence in society, I think have pretty interesting impact on kind of how we interact, interface. I think something that's probably more likely like to kind of we're starting to see is, you know, the Google I/O event just happened. And, you know, I think we're starting to see a lot of folks start to play around with whether it's, you know, glasses or goggles or something along that. But this idea of like an ever-present interface that is kind of both able to provide like kind of visual demonstration of something that you are interested in, or maybe auditory in real time. I mean, I think you probably saw the demo just like I did of, you know, kind of right now two folks talking in completely different languages and kind of it being translated in real time, which is yep. Amazing to see. But I do think that this interaction with, you know, kind of an ever-present element of technology as you are kind of having that interaction with other humans, I do think is going to have a real profound impact on kind of how we interface with one another as humans and how we interact with technology as well. And, you know, this coming back to education, I think, you know, one of the biggest questions is, well, look, this, the concept of right now, there's a need in some cases where you actually need to be able to retain a certain amount of information because you're going to have to know that information without having access to technology in real time. I think, you know, as these devices, whether it's goggles or Neuralink or other things like that, start to become more ubiquitous, like almost that like kind of fact or knowledge that you need to know is going to be kind of accessible by anyone, right? And so I think as you think about like, well, what does that mean then as we think about how to focus on education or what should we be thinking about then, I think is going to be a fascinating question for all of us to kind of start to consider.
You read my mind, and it's interesting is that I'm listening to you. You know, everyone, there's probably a consensus that you can see artificial intelligence drives a bigger emphasis on the subject matters that support it, math, learning. But I also can't help but to think that, you know, AI may take over so many basic functions of everyday living that it frees us up to focus on the creative arts. Because, yeah, I mean, I've seen Grok, you know, and other AI models spit out some pretty impressive, you know, pictures and now video. But, you know, I'm going to remain optimistic that it's still going to be really difficult to replace, you know, the things that make us human. And you could totally see, you know, this emphasis on subject matter that really is on creativity. You know, and to complement, you know, the technologists in among us. You know, one last question before we wrap up on the VC side. You know, would love to know the scope. So you're in this great position. You see a whole host of tools where you can provide support. But, you know, what's the degree that you'll get involved with founders after you've made an investment? And then if you could just complement that internally, how does OWL support or leverage technology, you know, either operationally or with your own staff to get the most out of the tools you guys see and use?
Yeah. So
I would say, you know, we do like to provide a lot of services and kind of be real thought partners to our entrepreneurs. I mean, we're usually taking board seats with the investments that we are making. And, you know, outside of just the capital investment that we're actually making in these businesses, I would say the few ways that I highlight that we work very closely with our entrepreneurs. One is, you know, given our vertical focus, we do have a lot of relationships with the customers that a lot of these companies are going to want to work with. So we think about like kind of how can we accelerate that go-to-market motion for these businesses, whether it's, you know, introductions to customers, channel partners, or other types of partnerships, whether it's content or distribution related, that could help kind of accelerate the growth rate of those businesses. I think second, coming back to my point about talent, you know, not only are we meeting with really interesting founders, but, you know, every week our team is talking to dozens of executives that are, you know, kind of coming from the general tech or education sector and saying, I want to come into the education technology sector, or might be coming from another role in the education technology sector and saying that they are looking for the next role. And so for us, that's a second way is kind of really helping ensure that our portfolio companies are able to recruit the best talent in those critical roles. And then I think third is related outcomes and efficacy work. So we actually have one of our partners who's full-time role is like basically focused on helping our companies think about outcomes and efficacy measurement and kind of really starting to walk on that spectrum from, it might be a little bit as you're an early stage company, don't have a whole lot of data, but more qualitative in nature to how do you actually make it more quantitative, much more rigorous so that it can be something that differentiates you from others out there. And then I would say, you know, the fourth and fifth things that I would mention, one is just like, kind of starting to think about like capital allocation strategy or downstream capital for our companies and kind of how to set yourself up for success and kind of helping companies understand like what are investors looking for? What do those benchmarks look like? And really playing an active role of kind of almost backwards planning from what the target might look like. And then the last thing is, you know, we're very fortunate to, between the founders that we have, as well as the LPs that we have in the fund, like have a pretty massive global network. And so a lot of our companies are thinking about, you know, not just how to serve students in their local geography, but also potentially how to think about maybe expanding to a different country, a different part of the world. And so we're pretty involved in helping them kind of accelerate that process as well too.
Fantastic. Amit, it's been a great podcast. We're close to wrapping up here. I have a go-to question I love to ask all of our guests, and it's a retrospective. And so if you had an opportunity to go back and have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
Interesting question.
I think it
comes back to the place where I've seen
the biggest difference
and the thing that gets me most excited, which is talent, and really focusing on, and it's not just in a founder position or in a executive full-time kind of position, but I think really finding, even from an advisor perspective, independent board member perspective, or any type of kind of high quality talent that can help companies, you know, A, understand what has been tried before. Why was somebody successful? Why was somebody not successful? So as they think about their journey, how they want to allocate resources, how they want to make investments, they just have that information and that data to understand and make an informed decision. And that's not to say, hey, just because somebody's tried something, you know, historically and 9 out of 10 times it didn't work, we shouldn't try it as well, because obviously the world changes, circumstances changes, and technology changes and so forth. But just, I guess, having an appreciation for how risky is this move that you're actually trying to make. And let's not all be surprised if, you know, hey, 9 out of 10 people failed and we're also failing at this. But and so having the talent that kind of has seen that, has understood that, and can be helpful when it comes to the company's future, I think I would say kind of find that for every company and for every founder, and that's going to be the biggest value that you could add.
Love it. Amit, more recent question. If there's anyone in your network who you'd like to see be a guest on the Innovators Investors podcast, who would you suggest?
Good question. I think if I think about like kind of folks that have had a really interesting impact on the education sector, I would say, kind of when it comes to higher education, I'd say two individuals. Paul LeBlanc, okay. Who kind of really put Southern New Hampshire University on the map, I think is really interesting, and someone that if you do have the chance to kind of interview, I think would be a fascinating conversation. And Michael Crow, who did that for ASU, I think is also somebody that I would suggest would be really interesting.
All right, I'm going to tell our production team to see if we can't convince them to come on the show. Amit, great podcast. Really appreciate your time. Any members of our audience want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
LinkedIn.
It's great. I'm on there. And so you can find me on LinkedIn.
Fantastic. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Amit Patel, Managing Director, Owl Ventures. Amit, thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Really enjoyed the discussion today.
Likewise. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO, FinStrat Management. It's been another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Take care.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.